Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 186 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and not Andrew Frankel this week. He's on holiday. But we've got, I think, an excellent stand-in. Blake Hinsey. Hello, Blake. Thanks for taking the time to do this podcast.
Hey, Dan. How are you doing today?
Really good. Really good. So let me explain who Blake is for those who don't know. You are a former F1 performance engineer, and we'll come on to your credentials in that space in a moment. Turned podcaster, YouTuber, content creator. That's a really interesting journey that you've had there. Let me get the plug in for your channels now. What you're looking for is the YouTube channel or the Instagram account called Break. That's Break with three R's. You've got 120,000 YouTube subs, 111,000 Instagram followers. You've only been going 18 months or something. So looking at those numbers, I mean, it seems to be going well, this content stuff for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's. I guess when you take a step back and look at it on the scale of 2 years, it feels like, wow, that looks pretty good. But like, I guess the eventual content grind you're looking at 2 days ago, it's like nothing happened in the last 2 days. It must be going terribly. But I think that's getting in the right headspace thing. But yeah, it's been a really interesting transition because honestly, I never really had any intention of being a motorsport content creator. It was kind of something. Yeah, it was. I think let's cut to it real quick. I basically did 10 years of Formula One, 6 years trackside, 4 years in the factory doing development work after that. And then I was like, you know what? I want a different challenge. And I thought I was going to do, I thought it was going to be a Warzone gaming content creator because I'd been streaming and gaming Warzone through lockdown as everybody unfolded a bunch of new hobbies and things they enjoyed through lockdown, I'm sure. And that was one of mine. I was like, I could make a living off of this, I think. And then I was like, something's missing here. And I was like, okay, well, why don't I start doing content about Formula One? And that's how it happened. It wasn't really like a deliberate thing to leave motorsport to do motorsport content. Right. It was, let's take a break from motorsport, do something else. And I was like, you know what? I don't love that as much as I still got the itch. I still want to analyze Formula One data. I still want to look at stuff. I want to have conversations with people. And like, I don't have an office full of people to talk to anymore. But I've got a internet of millions of people that I could potentially have conversations with. So I think that kind of summarizes that bit.
Well, what you're doing is, and maybe I've got a bone to pick with you here, you're making the rest of us who write and talk about F1 look a bit silly because you've got a background in the sport, 10 years as an engineer. You understand it inside out and upside down the way the rest of us from the outside probably can't. But let's establish your credentials. As you said, 10 years in F1 as an engineer, six of those trackside as a performance engineer. You worked hand in hand with Max Verstappen for 2 years, 2016 and 2017. You won a handful of races with him. So we'll come on to that in a little bit. I'm intrigued about how an American finds, you're from Texas, aren't you? How you find yourself in the world of F1? I mean, wouldn't it have been so much easier to get into IndyCar or NASCAR or something?
That's a really great question. And honestly, that was my first approach. It's like, well, let me try to find a job in NASCAR, IndyCar, sent out loads of resumes and CVs and emails. I got very few calls back, mostly no calls back. And I think I think it's easier to qualify that before that. So I started club racing Spec MX5 with my father, right?
Yeah.
And it was like, cool. I think that's cool. I didn't know what I wanted to do academically, professionally at that point. And we were fortunate enough to have a family friend that said, hey, here's some MX5s. That turned me on to mechanical engineering, which turned me on to the Formula SAE, or in the UK and Europe, it's Formula Student Program. And then from there, it was the hook. I was like, I need to go work in motorsport. No luck, IndyCar, no luck, NASCAR. And then it was like, oh, I see a lot of other Americans going to Oxford Brookes University to get a job in F1. And a lot of them had converted that master's degree into a job in the industry. I was like, cool, let's do that. So yeah, I hadn't lived outside of Texas. I was 25 when I moved to the UK, and I have lived here ever since then.
Mm. Yeah, so I mean, there's your background there. You did study mechanical engineering at Arlington, Texas. Then you did the motorsport master's degree at Oxford Brookes in the UK, involved in Formula Student. And I mean, tell me about that kind of grounding. Is that a fairly well-trodden path then through Oxford Brookes, the Formula Student program, into a professional career in racing?
In terms of if you looked at all the career paths, I think there's quite a significant statistical correlation to people that have done that program. I know quite a few people, but there's people from literally all over the world now in the Formula One industry. But at the time, there was a couple of us. Renault has John Howard's race engineering Gasly now at Alpine. He was 2 years before me, or a year before me, at Oxford Brookes. I know him quite well. So there's a lot of really interesting people that have, you know, come into Formula One, gone up the ranks, or come into Formula One, gone back to the US. But yeah, there's a lot of people that have taken that path. And yeah, I think mechanical engineering, and there's a lot of people that are, let's say, involved in Formula, say, a Formula Student. I wasn't just involved in it. I was consumed by it. Mm. And it was one of those things where there's a handful of people that get the bug badly. And even if they get stuck in completely, and they turn it into their entire personality, which is probably not, you know, it's not the best thing for having a really well-rounded life. Cause I don't think I took a vacation or anything for, like, I don't know. I did 5 years of Formula SAE throughout my undergrad and master's, and then straight into Force India.
Mm.
As a vehicle dynamics engineer, then 8 months later, I was trackside for the next 6 years. So,
I think you did 3 years with Force India, didn't you, before switching across to Red Bull?
Yeah.
And you're working with Daniel Kvyat initially, I think, weren't you? Yep.
I took the job to be Sebastian Vettel's performance engineer, and then in Japan that year, he announced he was going to Ferrari.
Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. I would have loved to work with Seb, honestly, but Danny's one of my favorite people that I've met in the industry, and he's such an awesome dude. But interestingly, a story that a lot of people don't know, but performance engineers and race engineers work together with a driver. I was performance engineering on the same car that GP Lambiese was race engineering at Force India. And then, lo and behold, I got the job at Red Bull. And then 2 months later, GP tells me he's leaving, and he doesn't tell me where. Mm. And then in Belgium that year, it comes out that he's going to Red Bull. And he was like, hey, did you check Twitter this morning? I was like, dude, it's Sunday before the race. I'm not checking Twitter. I don't use Twitter. I do now. And then it was confirmed that GP was also going to Red Bull as well. So I worked with GP another 3 years at the track with Kvyat, and then later Max. So that was a lot of fun.
So, tell me about Max Verstappen, 2016. Of course, we remember that Kvyat and Verstappen swapped seats, didn't they, at Toro Rosso and Red Bull. So Max comes in his rookie year, only a few races in. Was it his rookie year? Wasn't it 16?
No, I think it was one. I think he did a year before that.
He did a year before. Okay, so it's year two.
Don't quote me on that.
But I think most of us recognize that Verstappen looked like a ferocious talent.
Yeah,
and of course, I think ferocious, we know that's true now. But yeah.
I think being ferocious was quite key, because at the time he was known for being very aggressive, and a lot of people, it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But I think he learned a lot of those very difficult lessons very early, and now you see him very controlled, I think. Mm. And at times he's still definitely a lot more aggressive than a lot of the other people, but it's very interesting to see that. But when he showed up at Red Bull, he was, I forget how young he is. Was at the time and still is, but He was just super down to earth, super chilled out, very approachable, very friendly guy, and very quick in the simulator, which really doesn't always mean anything, because we've had lots of people that have been quick in the sim, and you know, when you go to the track to put together, they don't learn as quickly or they don't adapt as quickly as others. But he was outstanding out of the box, honestly. And then the first race, he barely got qualified, out-qualified by Daniel, and then went on to win that race. I think Daniel was a bit unlucky with the strategy, but that's racing as well. Max was there. He fought off Kimi. And that was my first win. That was GP's first win in Formula One, and obviously Max's first win.
So that's the 2016 Spanish Grand Prix, when we remember Rosberg and Hamilton, the two Mercedes, took each other out on the first lap. And then Max, in his first race for Red Bull, goes and wins the thing. So what are you seeing then in this young kid? Is it just astonishing speed? What's he doing in the car that makes him so quick?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of it's been discussed quite extensively, but I think it's one of those narratives, like you'll see the media lock onto certain narratives, and sometimes the narratives are nonsense. But one of the narratives that it's absolutely true is, the first thing is, he's able to deal with a relatively unstable car. And as many people know, is the more pointy or the more unstable and more front end the car has, the faster it will go if you can keep it on the track. And he can do that quite well. The other thing was, it wasn't quite apparent in the first race, but the second and third race with us, it was very apparent that he got up to speed very quickly. And his pace in free practice one out of the doors was very fast. And it was like, what's going on here? Whereas a lot of other people just build up throughout the weekend, free practice one, you know, do a low fuel run, check the high fuel balance, and out of the doors, second lap. It's like, what are these sector times? What are we looking at here? What's going on? Is Daniel sleeping or something? And it wasn't that. It was just the fact that we were taken aback by how quickly he was pushing so early in the session. You know, cold tires, not really cold tires, but like dirty track, low grip conditions. And he's taking more risks than other people quite early. And that helped him get up to speed very quickly in a race weekend, because he was already on the pace. Wow. And it was just something different. Like there's no rewards for being, you know, nearly losing it in free practice one. There's no rewards. And often, like I remember Austria, there was the sausage or baguette curbs on the outside of the high speed 6-7, or maybe it was 5-6 at the time, or whatever it was, the two left-handers. We come back in, it's like, yep, need to replace the floor. We need to replace the front wing. And he's like, I'm just finding out where the limits are. It's like, yeah, but that's the only wing we've got there. So that was interesting. But wow. I really enjoyed that. And I really wish, looking back on that, that the car was a little bit more reliable and the Renault engine was a little bit better at that time. And I think, but you know what? They're enjoying plenty of success now. And I'm happy sitting on the sidelines without all the politics and aggro, and just watching them do an exceptional job.
Sure. Well, we will come back to some of that. But while we're talking about Max Verstappen and what makes him special, before you worked with Max, you did work with Sergio Perez as his performance engineer. And I mean, I hold all of these guys in such high regard. If you can operate one of these cars at race speed, if you can win in one, if you can qualify on pole, you're God-level hero to me. You know, you just are.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are levels. And we've seen it this year that Perez, on his day, he can give Max a fright, but he's not on Max's level. And can you try and boil that down? What is the difference between a Verstappen and a very good multiple Grand Prix winner?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because you always saw, you saw in the Sauber back in the day, in the Force India Racing Point and whatever names that you know, Silverstone-based team held, Checo was getting some awesome race results. You know, our first season we had the podium in Bahrain, because that was in 14. And then after that, it was, you know, several awesome results and very good underdog performances. And then you turn the tables and Checo's in the best car on the grid going up against arguably one of the top drivers at the time. I think it's just a difficult measuring stick. And I'm not close enough to what's going on to give you a definitive answer on that, unfortunately, but I won't fluff it. You know, I can't extrapolate. But I think one of the things that is always clear is Max is able to drive the car a little bit more unstable. And there's a really interesting narrative that a lot of people say that the team develops the car for Max, which I don't think that's true, considering I worked in the simulator from 2018 to 2021. And a lot of that time, we spent a reasonable amount of time trying to help Max's teammate elevate their performance, looking at car setup ideas, car setup philosophies, changes that we needed to make the car for Gasly and Alex. Now, I wasn't there so much when Checo, that wasn't as big of a thing at that time. It was like, you know, we'll let Checo get up to speed and find his way. But, you know, that was something we spent a lot of time doing. They make the fastest car they can. It's not like they go through this checklist and say, Max, how would you like this car? And it's disagreed with Checo. And they're like, well, we'll pick the Max option. I've never seen that happen. Maybe it's happened in 22 and 23, but up until that point, between Max and his teammate, when Max was clearly the faster of the two, you never saw that kind of preferential treatment. So that was an interesting kind of myth to dispel.
But so Max, over the years, he has made life very difficult for a lot of extremely good drivers.
Absolutely.
Gasly, Albon, Perez, Ricciardo, perhaps. Is it fundamentally that being comfortable with rear instability that is the difference? He can handle a car that feels like it wants to get away from him, and the others haven't been able to the same degree?
Yeah, I think that's probably on like the first level. That's probably like a headline item of that. And at the same time, I think one of the other things, we maybe people do give him enough credit for that. Max is insanely consistent. Is one thing, A, and B, he. You know, we look back to Interlagos the other weekend. There's people like, you know, slowing down in the pit lane. He's like, no, I've got it. My tires are cooling off. I need to get the lap in. He just overtakes them on the grass in the pit lane exit. It's like, if you take that kind of philosophy and apply it to other things, he's doing that all the time to make sure he's super aggressive in terms of driving. And then in terms of qualifying laps, he doesn't really leave that much on the table too often. This year, he's had several laps where you could clearly see he left something on the table. And he says, Austin was a good example. He's like, yeah, I overcooked it at turn one. So I think he's quite honest with himself, and he knows where he is and where he isn't. And he's super consistent, and he's, you know, out laps, in laps, always flat chat, no leaving any time on the table. If there were fine margins, he would be, you know, the odds would be in his favor, because he's probably pushing a little bit harder than the next guy in the in lap or out lap, or, you know, some other, you know, subtle thing that might be taken for granted.
Blimey. Privilege, though, right? To get to work with a talent like Verstappen. He's a generational talent. We'll be talking about him for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think more, I'm kind of more enjoying watching it from the outside now, because I'm not, you know, I get to sit back and enjoy the races. Whereas when I was at the track or at the factory, I was so overwhelmed with whatever my job was, I didn't actually get to take a step back and look at the bigger picture and enjoy that. So, yeah. I think with the framing it with the context of having worked with him and seeing the initial, you know, a couple of years, and then being able to step back and, yeah. And honestly, I'm pretty happy to have avoided traveling during COVID times. That was not fun for anybody involved. So, even if I, funny, that was kind of like, yeah, I'm out.
Done.
Yeah.
We've spoken a lot about your role as a performance engineer. I think it actually might be helpful just to try and define that. Now, I'm guessing it means you're not designing the car. You're making the car that you've got go faster.
You're making the car that you've got go the least slow. I think that's honestly, you know, because I think one of those things when you're, especially me, I won't speak on other people's behalf, but me, you know, leaving Formula SA, Formula student, it's like, I want to go and, you know, I want to go find all the lap time and performance on the car. Formula One teams are huge. They've got so many simulations tool. They've got so many simulation tools. They've got great wind tunnels, great CFD. You're not going to just rock up and find a couple tenths a weekend with setup tools and everything else. You are going to have some hardships or something challenging, and you're going to find out how to make that thing not lose you a tenth. You're going to try to lose less than a hundredth or whatever that is. So a performance engineer is very similar to the race engineer. And this varies in racing disciplines. Like, for example, in sports cars, you probably won't have a race engineer and a performance engineer. You'll have a race engineer and a data engineer. And that data engineer will do everything from IT networks to updating the ECUs, programming this telemetry, whereas in Formula One, the performance engineer is focused on performance data. So telemetry comparisons, which is something I spend a lot of time doing now outside of the sport, tools set up like your differential, your brake balance, brakes management, making sure the brakes are performing well, giving information to the race engineer and strategist to help understand where the tires are at, where the performance is at, and anything the driver can do to help improve his performance or minimize performance loss effectively. So I think that's a really good summary of what a performance engineer does. And then the race engineer is focused on the top level stuff, setting the tire pressures, talking to the driver, monitoring traffic, and kind of pulling the big picture together. Whereas the performance engineer is all the details and data supporting the race engineer and pit wall to make those key decisions during the race and then offer the most concise and useful feedback to the driver.
And so before the race, through the practice sessions, you must just be working hand in glove with the driver, listening to their feedback and working out what you're going to do with the various tools that you have. The basic suspension settings, I'm sure, differentials, maybe there's some aero stuff.
Yeah.
So how reliant are you on what, on the driver's feedback?
Entirely. Yeah. Because the goal is, the pitfall is looking at the data and say, the data says we need to do this.
Mm.
The through time you gain experience of saying the data says this, the driver says this, which one do you listen to and why? Do you need to push the driver to change their mind? Or is there something you've misinterpreted in the data and you need to better understand what the driver's telling you and look somewhere else to solve that problem? So that's one of those things. Because a lot of the time you say, this is the optimum setup. You should drive this. And it's like, no, I can't drive this for these three reasons. And then it's your job to understand the language they're using and convert that into actionable items and then know which system or area of the car you're going to address to improve that deficiency. And that's the fun part, is going from the language, which might be abstract and no significant meaningful engineering purpose whatsoever, and then converting that into an action that you perform or the race engineer performs, or informs the aerodynamicists about the behavior of the car that they need to either address on the short term or address in the upgrade coming next month, kind of thing.
Mm.
It's I haven't thought about it like that in a while, but it's a mess.
It just seems like there are so many variables, so many different elements on the car that you can toy with. If I'm your driver and I come in FP1 and I'm furious and I'm dead slow and I just tell you car's got no front end, what are you going to do? What's your first sort of port of call there?
The first thing you would like, that kind of thing, if you've had a disaster free practice one, let's say you every other weekend you're great and this weekend you're absolutely shocking. We've been to this track before, we know it well. The first thing is everybody's making sure the things that you're observing or reading are correct. And then the first thing you're looking at is, are the tires actually working? Yes or no? That's one of those things. And okay, if you're saying the car's understeering like a pig, it's like, what is your teammate saying? Is there anything we can understand between those two? Because you have two resources. Like the drivers might have different preferences, but if one driver's in the ballpark and there's a usual offset between those two drivers, you're checking that. More often than not, when you have weekends like that where you're kind of like, what the heck? I didn't expect us to be nowhere. It's very often a tires thing. A little bit of foreshadowing to this weekend coming in Las Vegas.
But oh, yes.
There's going to be a lot of people trusting their guns, and then a lot of people being super reactionary and possibly getting it wrong, or maybe getting it much better than everybody else. Who knows?
It's going to be interesting, isn't it? It is going to be interesting.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Interesting. Yeah, so the tyres, I mean, we hear a lot about tyres, don't we? It feels like F1 has become 50, 70, 80% getting your tyres working and keeping them working through a stint. So I guess they have a fine operating window. Outside of it, you're getting no grip.
Yep.
And if you can key the car in, dial the car into that little window, it's going to come together and work perfectly.
Yep. Yeah, you see teams like Haas is a great example of getting the tires working on a single lap. And in the race, not only is their pace not great, they also have insane degradation as well. Mm. We saw Mercedes last weekend in Brazil with huge deg and also no pace. And maybe that's a little bit of a setup thing in car development, but also it's like that's a fundamental tire problem as well. It's one of those things because the tires are the only thing touching the ground, and they are the part of the equation that the teams, despite all the modeling and information from Pirelli, it's the thing that the teams know the least about, genuinely. Really? Yeah. There are people that are doing a very good job through time, building up a good picture and understanding of that Pirelli tire. Red Bull have done a very good job at it because you see them making strange compromises in qualifying sometimes in order to not chase the final bit of track evolution. The last 2 minutes in qualifying three are so fast. They're like, you know what? We'll go out a minute early so we can have clear track so that the driver for sure can hit their warm-up schedule on that tire, because it's not only like where it's at the moment that's important. It's how you bring the tire in. And you'll hear a lot of people, especially Red Bull, on the pit wall during the race talking about, make sure to bring these tires in easily, because if you cook them too quickly, you change the chemical compound or the chemical makeup of the tire, and then it never produces good adhesion throughout the rest of that stint.
Do we hear too much about tires? Are they too big a factor?
Now we're getting into trouble here. I don't know. It genuinely is a great question, because I think... you don't want to hear, like, let's make it an obscure example. Let's say every weekend's race performance was dictated by gearbox performance.
Yeah.
Who cares? Formula One, seamless shift gearboxes are insane. They're basically engaging two gears at once. There's milliseconds between one barrel and one gear engaged and the next barrel and the next gear engaged. It's amazing. We can only talk about it so much, but like, you could at least take a gearbox apart and show people what it looks like. But if every weekend's race performance was like, oh yeah, their gearbox efficiency this week's not very good, you'd just be like, man, turn this off. I'm going to go watch something else, man.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, something else, but maybe, I don't know. I think tires are a bit of chaos. And I think, as long as it's not too artificial, and I don't think this is too bad, I think the tires add a level of uncertainty that make this enjoyable and as predictable and inevitable as Max Verstappen winning the season because of Max plus that car is insane. I enjoy the chaos that we see with tires, and it's much, much similar to where we've got a mixed wet dry weekend. You know, the strategy / tire scenario is chaos. And I like that because I can't tell you what's going to happen. Sometimes I can make a good guess and a well-informed guess. But sometimes I don't know what's going to happen, and I kind of enjoy that.
I stitched you up there a little bit, but yeah, you handled that beautifully. I do agree with you, though. Yeah,
I agree with you, though. It's like, do we talk about him too much?
I suppose, as you say, if we did just have very predictable tires with very long life and very, very well-known characteristics, we'd just see the fastest car and the fastest driver disappear into the distance every time.
Every weekend, instead of having these weekends where Singapore Red Bull lost, these, you know, Mercedes getting closer, Brazil lost. You know, those weekends throw, I don't think they're artificial. All the teams have the same opportunities to learn those things about their cars and those tires, but it's the combination of the driver, the team, the engineers, and the way they've interpreted what they've had. Have they missed or not? And I like that you can miss. I like that you can have the best teams in the world messing up.
Yeah. And there you go. That's the bit of chaos that you get from those Pirelli tires.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
So is the sort of fundamental setup stuff already decided? When you get to a track on a normal weekend, are you discussing anti-roll bar rates? Are you discussing spring rates? Are you discussing ride height, or has that stuff basically been set earlier in the week?
The teams that have everything locked down, they start in a very good window. And, you know, we've got sprint weekends now where you get one free practice session to set up the car. Teams, they have to be very clear that their hit rate is going to be high when they roll out of the pre-event work in the driver in the loop simulator. You know, these simulators are nothing like that you've seen in terms of the consumer stuff you've gone to. You know, there's the automotive fair, the simulator expo. The stuff that these teams have is nothing like this stuff. It's a completely different world that I can't talk about. But at the same time, like, you're relying on these models being good, the prep work being good, the aero maps and their understanding of the car being good, and they've updated all their models, so it's, you know, as close as they can get. And there's still reasonable uncertainties that you have to understand when you make the decisions off that information. But yeah, I mean, the teams need to rock up with a very high hit rate. And are you probably in the ballpark in ride height? Yes. Are you possibly going to try, you know, say you have a question mark, is like, is our ride height better when it's a little bit higher? Like, where's the peak? I'm not really sure. We've had some conflicting information last couple of weeks. Okay, what we'll do is we'll try baseline ride height and then ride height plus 5 mil. 5 mil is a pretty big step. It's a huge step, which, you know, when you get out a measuring device and you're like, yeah, there's 5 mil, and this car's gone from fine to undrivable.
Yeah.
So it's mad. It's actually mad when you look at it. Like, 1 millimeter front ride height is substantial.
And but in terms of lap time or what the driver can feel, or
both. But it could be both. You know, in terms of rear ride height, can change characteristics massively in terms of where your peak is, and then front ride height will just add front load, so you need to rebalance that. But in terms of like anti roll bars and stuff, yeah, you're changing those because, again, those go back to what you don't understand about the tire and the tarmac and the surface and the conditions. So yeah, it's okay. It's a little bit hotter. We need to be a little bit more stable. So we'll go one step softer on the rear anti-roll bar or something. But you kind of have a rough idea. And those are the fundamental things you're chasing every week. And it's like, okay, the car is a little bit more understeer than we thought. Do we tackle this with camber? Do we tackle it with mechanical balance like the anti-roll bars? Are we out in the ride heights a little bit, or what is that? So yeah, but some teams will show up, like, I'm sure Mercedes were like, what the hell do we do in Brazil? It's like, that's bad. It's not a happy place to be. And like, everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's looking at the data. Nobody has any conclusion on where to go. That's a tough weekend.
It says that they still don't really understand that car, I guess. But I love that in this hyper sophisticated, technologically advanced world of Formula One, there are still guys with spanners dealing with anti-roll bars and camber and toe and all that stuff. Yeah. It's fantastic because that's proper motorsport mechanical engineering, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the bolts and the nuts of the whole thing. It's like, this is it. And that's one for the things for me. It's like, if I went back into motorsport, one of the things I would like to do would be to race engineer GT3 car. You know, just like a proper sports car. You know, you've got lots of adjustability, lots of things to play with. And you've got all sorts of other, you know, compromises like the Pro-Am driver arrangement and all that. But that's a different story. But it is very much, these cars look and feel quite alien compared to a sports car or a weekend car. But you are playing with some of the same parameters. You just have a lot more information at your disposal, for the better or for worse.
When have you been amazed by a driver being able to sense and interpret a minuscule chassis setup change? When have they really amazed you with that feel, that skill?
I don't have one of those stories like, was it Raikkonen or Mika Hakkinen saying like the chassis was cracked, you need to go check it. Yeah. Sure enough, the chassis was cracked. I don't have any of those stories, but there's some stuff where it's like the driver's like, something's wrong, and it's like, oh yeah, you've got a different anti-roll bar or a different side spring in the left and the right. We checked that after the session, it was wrong. Or I think a lot of it just comes from the thing that I think is most impressive is drivers like Max and Fernando's ability to, like you said at the beginning of this call, is to drive these things on the ragged edge, but at the same time, which to me is like, with all my focus and concentration and years of preparation, I would never reach that because my skill ceiling is very low.
Same.
But with all of that, they're able to operate this machine that requires super fast reactions at super fast muscle memory responses, feeling, adapt to that, And they'd be like, oh yeah, I've just noticed that so-and-so's pitted. I heard them in the pit lane, or I saw it on the television as I was breaking for turn one. I was like, you're telling me you're watching TV as you're breaking for turn one? That's the kind of thing. And it's silly, but it is impressive. It's like, it's actually mind blowing. Mm. The same thing. There's a picture in Silverstone. I believe it was Max going through Maggots Beckett's, and he's looking outside of the corner as he's turning in. It's not because he has a left hand coming up. It's because he's watching the TV in the middle of the fastest corners on the circuit. I was like, what the hell is that? He's literally, I think it was an overcast day, so he had a clear visor. You can see him, and he's looking out the corner of his eye up at the television in the middle of the fastest corner complex, or one of the fastest corner complex on the Formula One calendar. I was like, okay, dude, eyes on the road.
But this is why we love it, isn't it? Because these guys are—they're almost aliens to us. Their capability in these machines is just staggering. They're heroes. That's why I love it. That's why I love watching it. So you were at Red Bull for 7 years. And I suspect you felt for a good number of those years that you probably had the best chassis, the best aero, but you had a Renault power unit that perhaps wasn't on the pace of the Ferrari, of the Mercedes?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I don't think there's... I'd be willing to say that you probably won't find anybody that's well-informed on that that would disagree with that.
Yeah.
You know, you could argue, but I think chassis was great. Aero was pretty good. There was some, you know, both of them had some deficiencies and balance issues at times, but they were both pretty good. And I think also the other thing we're looking at is we were near the end of a regulation cycle. You know, the 13-inch, the V6 hybrids have been, you know, plateaued. You know, Ferrari was where they were. Then they lost their fuel flow meter. Mercedes was on top of that. And then the Renault was just kind of like, kind of average.
Mm.
Kind of not great, honestly. But anyway, having seen secondhand, being at the factory, not trackside with Honda, having had a Mercedes power unit at Force India and having a Renault, there was a night and day difference between those two and the way they operated, and the consistency and the preparation compared to the Renault. Like the people we worked with at the track were phenomenal.
Yeah.
The engineers, all of them. But it was just something about the way that they were developed, and you know, the information they had and the certainty they had about stuff.
Mm.
It was Mercedes and Honda were very, very impressive, and I think the other ones were not really on the same level. Yeah, honestly,
interesting. And I mean, we sit now, don't we, with a very competitive power unit in the back of that Red Bull, and what's clearly a phenomenal chassis. That car is just astonishing this year. Did you get to work closely enough with Adrian Newey to see his genius at work?
No, not really. Like, because at the track, he would be in there. You know, he was at most of the races. I think there was one season he wasn't there at every race, but he was always there. And in terms of like having a detailed interaction with him about solving a problem or something else, no, I didn't really get to experience that. A lot of the people that worked in Aero would, you know, they'd have meetings with him all the time. He was like, hey, Adrian, I've got this idea. Can we talk about this? And, you know, you'd get to pick his brain. I never was in the fortunate enough position to get to work super closely with him, which is regrettable a little bit, because he's one of those people, like, I don't know, Adrian Newey's, the Ross Brawns, like, we're not going to have engineers like that soon. Everybody's too specialized. Whereas these guys, you know, started, you know, drawing the cars, designing the cars, and then race engineering the Formula One cars on the race weekends. We don't have those people with that kind of breadth anymore. Mm. And then you have people like that who also have immense depth in a certain aspect of or another. It's like, I don't think, looking at the team and the people I know there, I don't think I know anybody that has that kind of depth. There's some excellent generalists that keep, you know, they have got a good view of everything. They can keep the ship moving in the right direction. You've got Adrian with his technical expertise, you know, refining these designs to make sure they make sense and they're finding the right performance out of it. But I don't see anybody that can do everything.
Mm. That's a very good point. Yeah, because these guys started when there were just a handful of people within a Formula, even a Formula One team.
Yeah. I mean, Formula student teams are now probably bigger in terms of personnel and resources than F1 teams were 30 years ago.
Wow.
Or 20 years ago. Oh. 30 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
In the 80s, Formula One was like dark ages still, you know, and even before that. So maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I don't think it's too far off.
Mm.
That's actually wild.
We love to hold Adrian Newey up as this extraordinary figure, as though he deserves all of the credit for Red Bull's current success. But where do you put it? I mean, he's clearly working with a team of supremely capable, talented aero engineers in particular. Does he deserve, does it basically come from him, or could you actually now take him away and the Red Bull machine would continue to build amazing cars?
Okay, adding that, so I think if you asked him, I think Adrian would be quite humble, but I would love to hear that question asked of him, and I think I know the answer would be, it would be like, you couldn't do it without all of those people, but to come back to that question, if you took Adrian out of that, would that car be where it is today? I don't think so.
Wow.
But but does he deserve all the credit? No, because no single person can do that on their own. Like the amount of simulation analysis and finding holes in design philosophies and ideas and be like, oh, this design doesn't work because of this. It's not stuff that he can just see in his head. And I feel like the strength is over the years, the processes they've developed together and ways of working together with, you know, one of the greatest aerodynamicists in motorsport, and then building up an amazing team. But there are people moving out from that structure as well. You know, you had Dan Fallows going over to Aston. They've had an amazing start to the season, a little bit of a downturn, and they look like they've turned it around. You've lost several other key people from that structure, but it's like the balance of that seems to be working still, because aerodynamically and philosophically as a whole, the car basically does everything this season. It's low drag, high downforce, not too high downforce, you know, but it does literally everything. The chassis is well balanced. It's good on the tires. You've got two phenomenal drivers. Max obviously way ahead right now in all the aspects, but it's the perfect storm, really, isn't it?
It's a great team, isn't it? That's the point. It's a great team.
Yeah.
So you were in F1 for 10 years, most of those trackside, going to every race, I presume.
Yep.
What's that? Does that take its toll?
Yeah.
There's a lot. I mean, maybe more now than when you were in F1, but you must have been doing 20-odd Grand Prix a year, something like that.
Yeah, I think when I started, it was 19 up to 21, 22.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was performance engineering every weekend. We'd leave the circuit. Like, here's a good way to look at it. It's Sunday night at Barcelona. Not Barcelona was straight into a test, actually. But say it's another European race in Monza. You finish the race on Sunday. You go get changed in the car park. So you're in your underwear, putting on your travel jeans and a travel shirt on top of being sweaty as hell. You get in the van. You drive to the airport. You get home at midnight. You're in the office the next morning at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, getting ready for the next weekend. That was it the entire year. You know, and then like on the when you didn't have a back-to-back or something like that. And then I would be race engineering. If we had a Pirelli test mid-season, or like in Barcelona, if there's a test up, I'd be race engineering the car, and the race engineer would go back and start focusing on setting up the car for the next weekend. So that was pretty nutty, but now it's even worse than that. You know, we're talking 23, 24 races, triple headers, flyaways, Vegas back to back with Abu Dhabi. a couple of my friends, I still talk to a lot of the guys and gals that work there, and it's tough. It's super tough, but.
Is that one of the reasons why you thought, enough of this, I'm going to go do something else?
Yeah, there's two aspects of that. When I left trackside to go to the factory, I was like, I've had my fill. Like, I always thought I wanted to be a race engineer, then I was performance engineer. I was like, I don't actually want to be a race engineer in Formula One. Like, that, the skills, the responsibilities, they don't excite me that much, because it's a very operational job. You're not doing much of the stuff. You're coordinating all the stuff together, and it requires a very specific set of skills, and I learned some of them. I learned quite a few of those skills, but at the same time, it's like my interest and passion is in development and learning. I want to learn how to make the car go faster. I want to find performance for the next 2 months. I want to find performance for the next year's car. I want to develop tools, because it's like I've got all these questions that you never have time to properly answer in the constraints of a weekend, and then in context of going from one event, preparing for the next, going to the next event. It was very rinse, repeat, and you don't have downtime to develop tools and processes to make better decisions in the long term. So that was what I wanted to do. And the simulator performance engineering environment was perfect for that because I could stay close to running the car in the virtual world, be close to what's happening on track, and at the same time develop tools to better analyze and better understand the masses of data that we're getting from both the track and the simulator and help the team make better decisions with that info. And that was, you know, very similar to what I was doing then. And that's kind of a very good analogy of what I'm doing now. It's like I got tired of Formula One. I got forced more into, you know, a very rinse, repeat, doing that same stuff over and over, and didn't have the time to really develop stuff. And I was like, okay, I'll take a break and go do gaming content. And then very quickly I realized it's like, we've got a Python API to access a lot of the F1 telemetry. Why don't I do this? Yeah. So I was like, why don't I do the exact same thing that I'm doing now? And instead of inform the team on how to make the car go faster, I can start dialogues and technical discussions with the Formula One audience as a whole.
Mm.
I think that kind of like,
that's brilliant.
Wraps the whole thing in a loop.
It's brilliant. Yeah, because we're talking about one of the most complex sports on the planet. And as a fan, trying to get your head around it, trying to understand it, can be extremely difficult. And with your background, your ability to interpret the data as well, you can tell us what's really going on. And that's what you do.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things. It's like there's like and you said it at the beginning, and I wanted to correct you on that. You said something to the effect of, you know, me having a lot of experience make a lot of the journalists and people that are discussing Formula One look bad. But at the same time, the way I consume and talk about Formula One is completely different to what other people do. And it doesn't always make it right. Mm. I can't remember, you know, when I'm having a conversation with you, I can't remember stuff that happened 3 weeks ago. Whereas a lot of people will remember that and be able to put that context together quickly and ask really interesting questions. I can't do that. I've got to go away, make a story, write something down, look at all the information, summarize all the facts, and then try to build a story out of that. But at the same time, I still don't remember what happened. You know, all the details of somebody remembers something specific that happened 3 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago at a race. I'm like, no, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
So, I can't be that quick on my feet with it. But at the same time, I do consume the sport and talk about it through a different lens. Mm. And then I can help give context to, there are a lot of misconceptions and a lot of, I wouldn't say misinformation, but like incorrect assumptions about how things work.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the great things is like, I can see those and hopefully I can gracefully talk about those and like debunk them a little bit and be like, that's interesting. And I think it makes sense, but let's look at, you know, and I can walk through fundamentals into as deep as anybody has time to listen.
Mm.
And if I don't know that thing, I at least can go away and research it. And I can get to the root of it pretty quickly because I don't, you know, my specialty is vehicle dynamics and vehicle performance. And even then, like, I've got a vehicle dynamics textbook behind me because I don't remember that stuff very well. And it's like, that's interesting. Somebody said something I don't agree with. Let's go back to first principles. Does this make sense or not?
Mm.
And then oftentimes I have to reteach myself things. And my old boss said it very well, like having to teach people stuff is a really good way of identifying gaps in your own understanding of a topic. Because if somebody said, well, how does this work? I'd be like,
actually,
I know how to work with it.
Yeah.
And I know how to get a result out of it. But if you ask me how it works, that's a different question, which is fun.
Mm. So particularly during a race weekend and perhaps the build up as well, you're podcasting, you're tweeting, you're on Instagram, just to get the plug in again, your accounts are Break with 3 R's.
Yep.
And you're tweeting and you're posting on Instagram and so on. You're often producing short videos, reels or shorts on YouTube, where you tackle a topic. It might be flexi wings, or it might be how the DRS works or something like that. What is it that you're fundamentally trying to do? Is it explain a complicated thing to a passionate audience? Is that fundamentally what you set out to
do? Yeah, I think so. And I think if I wanted to explain what it does, on the surface of it, it's make Formula One easy to understand.
Yeah.
Because Formula One seems daunting, intimidating. It's not that difficult, but you have to be able to explain it well. And it's like, okay, that's a challenge for me because I have to go back and relearn a lot of these things so that I can properly explain it. The other thing is, invite a new audience in and show people, like, even in seasons like this where we have what looks like a single card domination, and the narratives that you can derive off of that by traditional means aren't that many. But it's like, okay, well, there's some interesting stories. What does McLaren's, you know, form change look like, and where did it come from, and how did it come about, and what are the topics we need to talk about? And that's, you know, this video that has 5 points. And then for the people that are interested, there's 5 videos that are deep dives on every single one of those facets. And it's just finding the time and finding the most interesting threads on that to pull on to, because it is a technical sport, and the broadcasters are not doing a very good job of telling the technical stories to the audience. And how do you get young men and women interested in motorsport engineering when they don't know what it is? And that's, I think that's a good summary of what I'm trying to do. So, yeah. You know, I'm doing my newsletter, doing the deep dives and all the stuff. You'll see a lot of the subsets of that stuff in my videos. I'm live streaming, like basically sidecasting my own race commentary, talking about what's happening for pretty much every qualifying in the race over on YouTube and Twitch. And, you know, through that, we're bringing a lot of new people that are like on the fringes, or like, you know, Drive to Survive got them into it. They're like, what's next? The Drive to Survive series is over, and I don't find the you know, traditional broadcast very inviting, because, you know, the barrier to entry is possibly too high, or I want to ask some stupid questions. In air quotes, there are no stupid questions. So I think that's a good summary of what I'm trying to do and what I'm enjoying doing the most.
And during the weekend, are you poring over telemetry, over data, and figuring out why we're seeing what we're seeing?
Yeah, every time the session's over, after 30 minutes, I can download the telemetry. I can run through my report template, which has checkpoints to check kind of all the details, like why they were fast, why they were slow. Are people running high or low downforce? What do people look like on their tires? What is the strategy going to look like for the weekend? And that's the kind of stuff that I'm doing. Yeah, I can't get away from it. So unfortunately, there's 24 something races a year. So there goes 24 weekends, but at the same time, I do enjoy it, and I feel like I found a place where I can add value to the audience, to the sport.
I wrote a piece last week for the Intercooler on the app and website about being a fan of Formula One in 2023. And I think it's fantastic in many ways, because there's so much expertise out there, and absolutely you fit into this. And there are so many brilliant people explaining what's going on in Formula One. And the access is unbelievable these days. I remember, and I wrote about this, I remember the social media blackout in F1, when teams literally weren't allowed to post videos from the pits and paddock. But now they do such a good job, and you are invited into this world, and you can get so close to it if you want to. I love that side of it. But then, on the other hand, a lot of the social media around Formula One is fairly bitter and pretty hate-filled, isn't it? Do you see that side of it as well?
Absolutely. But basically, my strategy is to mute anybody with a driver as their profile picture. Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton, Charles Leclerc, Carlos Sainz, Lando Norris. I just mute all those people.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking. But yeah, there is a lot of, I think, the tribalism, effectively, which makes it. But I think that's also a side effect of any sport that's reached a certain mass, isn't it? So it's like, you know what, like, yeah, protect yourself. Stay away from the divisive, toxic discussions. There's been a lot of really upsetting moments in the sport, especially 2021. Like, you know, that is, you know, a black mark on the sport, effectively, in the way it's been handled and managed, and the whole thing, fine. But at the same time, it's like, who are we upset at? Is it teams? Is it people? Is it the organization? I think it was the organization that people should be upset with more than anything. But at the same time, yeah, you got to protect yourself and stay away from those conversations that will draw you in, because you see them consume a lot of people, and it's their entire personality, which is a bit unfortunate, considering there's so much good to talk about. Yeah. It's not all great, fine, but there's so much better stuff to talk about, and I do my best to avoid that and focus on the objectivity and interesting stories that are technical in nature, and hell, taking the piss half the time as well, just for the bants.
Let's not forget to do that.
Yeah.
All right. So to wrap things up, just a couple more questions. What are you hoping for next year, next season?
Next season, if I had my prayers answered, we would have 5 different teams win a Grand Prix next year on merit.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. You know, I don't think you're going to have the bottom 5 punching. Like, I think, you know, Alfa Romeo, AlphaTauri, Williams, Haas, you know, they've got a little ways to go, and I don't think you'll see them close that gap. It'd be great if they did. You know, for example, Aston Martin last season, at the end of last season, were shocking. Seb getting knocked out in Q1 almost every weekend, and that terrible radio message. He's like, not again.
Mm.
And then, you know, they were frequently on the podium at the start of the season. I think that's what I'd like to see. I think this rule set has achieved what it's meant to achieve in terms of letting cars race for subsequent laps. Unfortunately, the introduction of a regulation set change does throw the pecking order into chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Mercedes make gambles with a car philosophy, and they doubled down on it for a second year, and it's not paid off. So, you know, that can happen still. That's not the rules. That is teams and potentially bad decisions. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see more race winners. Love to see them scrap the 2026 engine regulations.
Really?
Yeah, I'd love to see them scrap that. That is going to be a mess. I hope it's not.
Gosh.
I don't want to be that negative, but it looks like not good, basically.
Do you think Red Bull have got the next couple of seasons wrapped up? Are they just too far ahead?
Probably.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll see next season other teams taking some race wins off of them, fine, but there's nothing that's going to happen until the new engine comes out that I think can really destabilize them in terms of where they're at. And, you know, as a result of winning the Constructors' Championship, they have less aero development and so on, but they're already so far ahead of everybody else. Like, yeah, the cost cap and the sliding scale of performance still has, I think it's a good idea. The cost cap also has some very bad things, like personnel salaries, which is very bad for the sport. And you're seeing a lot of teams brain drain, and you're seeing teams struggle to attract talent because the opening salary for a junior engineer, it's like they can literally go make double that in other industries out of university.
Really?
Wow. It's bad. Yeah.
Bloody hell. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, it's a huge implication. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, final one then. We've got the Las Vegas Grand Prix coming up this weekend. The first Las Vegas Grand Prix. It's on the strip, running down the strip. It looks like it's going to be cold because it's November in Las Vegas and it's at night.
Yeah.
What are we going to see? Chaos?
I think so. Turn back to really far back. USA Grand Prix 2012 at Austin. New tarmac is notoriously slick. You know, you don't have the basically the tarmac stones polished down and have the bitumen removed from them. So the level of adhesion is relatively low. Fast forward a little bit further, Turkey 21.
Yeah.
I believe it was. Brand new surface there. Slick as shit. I mean, that was a sketchy race track as the track built up. Now we've got Vegas. Cold track. I think there was speculation that the forecast could be like down at 5 degrees Celsius, which is like, I think, close to 40 Fahrenheit, which is cold. I think it's going to be closer to 10 looking at the recent forecasts. But that's still cold, and you have a new tarmac, and there's no other support series on the track to help clean that tarmac up and bring that surface in. So you're only going to have that. So cold tires, you're going to have a lot of teams. You know, it's like the car setup should be about right, but are they chasing their tails because the tires and track combination aren't producing grip? Whereas, you know, and if they adjust for free practice 1 and free practice 2, are they going to be lost by qualifying because the track is completely different? Possibly. You're going to see that happen to some teams for sure. Long 1.8 kilometers straight down the strip, a couple of probably high speed kinks and low speed corners. I don't know. I think it's going to be a mess. I really think it's going to be a mess. I'm hopeful. I'm wishful.
Max is going to win, right?
Probably. but at the same time, I think the overtaking ability on this track will be quite straightforward, especially with the straight and if you've got a top speed and DRS advantage. In terms of setup, I think they'll end up somewhere like they're running in Baku. So, you know, Baku is all these low speed 90 degree corners through sectors 1 and 2, and then effectively over 2 kilometers straight with some kinks on it on the back. And most of the teams optimize their top speed there because you can't overtake in the low speed stuff. So if you're a bit slower because you don't have as much wing on the car, fine. Then you go onto the back straight and that's where the happens. And if you can't overtake, you're in trouble.
Yeah. If you've got too much drag on, you're just a sitting duck, aren't you? And everyone's
going. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You're going to see what happened to McLaren in Belgium this year, where they didn't have a lower downforce wing. They were fast through sector two and they just got eaten alive and down to turn five. So,
well, bring on the Las Vegas Grand Prix.
I'm stoked.
Yeah. But until then, Blake, thank you for joining us on the podcast. We'll put links to your different channels in the description of this episode. Awesome. Thank you for coming on, taking the time to talk. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, Dan, thank you so much, and all the best, and we'll see you around soon, man.
Thank you, Blake. Cheers.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.